Like to introduce to the court this morning Mr. Kyle Soley of the Reed Smith firm, who will be making the argument this morning on behalf of Dial Corporation. He's been admitted pro hoc vice.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
May it please the court, I'm Gordon Stewart of the Stewart Law Firm, representing the appellant, Ford Motor Company. I'm here with Keith Sadison, also of the Stewart Law Firm, and with my co-counsel from Morrison & Forrester, admitted pro hoc, Paul Frankel, and Erwin Slomka.
Good morning. Welcome to the court.
And Mr. Frankel will deliver the argument today. Thank you.
Yes, please do.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm John McDaniel. I represent the Director of Revenue in these two cases. Both of these cases are challenges under the Commerce Clause, specifically the fair apportionment principles expressed by Supreme Court cases, to the wholesaler's gross receipts tax of this state. Additionally, Ford has alleged the tax discriminates against interstate commerce and also has made a statutory construction argument that it has not made physical delivery of goods in Delaware.
Mr. McDaniel, help us out here. As I understand it, both the Dial and the Ford cases involve the same critical master facts. Is that right?
The facts, in my view, are analytically similar, if not identical.
But, I mean, there's no material difference for analytical purposes.
No, Your Honor.
And they both involve the same issue, which is external consistency.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the only issue.
As I said, Ford has also challenged under Commerce Clause principles whether the tax discriminates against interstate commerce and has made a statutory construction argument. I believe that the disposition of the fair apportionment question, and specifically the agreement that the internal consistency test has been met, which the court and all the parties agree, should decide the discrimination question. So clearly the major issue in the case is the external consistency test.
Is that the same as fair apportionment?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court has developed, following Complete Auto Transit v. Brady, a line of cases that have interpreted the fair apportionment requirement. If you will, there are two sub-tests. One is called internal consistency, which is not an issue in this case. And very briefly, that's simply if every state had exactly the same statute, would more than 100% of the pertinent tax base be taxed? The external consistency subtest, if you will, of fair apportionment focuses on whether the state's method of dividing the tax base reflects a reasonable sense of how income is generated. And a challenger really has to show by clear and cogent evidence that the extraterritorial value being taxed, if any, is out of all proportion to economic activity in the state.
And this, am I correct in my general understanding that to violate the fair apportionment test, you have to be pretty far over the line?
So yes, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has allowed the states a wide latitude in devising methods that are constitutionally acceptable to divide a tax base.
And again, just so that I'm clear, if I understand the way the trial court approached it, the distinction between the two decisions that it rendered was based upon where title passed?
Yes, Your Honor, and the state's position is that that is not a determinative fact in any way. The trial court seemed to be troubled in the Dial case by the same sorts of concerns that really would go more to the substantial nexus prong of Complete Auto Transit. However, the parties stipulated that substantial nexus, and there was no disagreement.
In both cases?
In both cases, yes, Your Honor. And I believe that the trial court essentially imported the same sorts of facts and analysis that it would have engaged in a nexus determination in the course of determining whether the tax was fairly apportioned, and I believe that was error. I believe it got it right substantially in the Ford case.
If you have someone who's in the business of wholesaling, manufacturing something and wholesaling it. And they do that in one state, and then they deliver it in another state. Can both activities be taxed 100% in those respective states?
The Tyler Pipe case has pretty clearly set forth that manufacturing and wholesaling are different activities for these purposes. So the answer to your question, Your Honor, would be yes, that a manufacturer's tax could be imposed in the state of manufacture. And
but if they labeled it a wholesaler tax, it would fail. So the label determines that?
Not the label, Your Honor, the activity being taxed. In the one case, it's the activity of manufacturing, and in the other, the activity of wholesaling. And the Supreme Court has found pretty clearly in the Tyler Pipe case that those are two different activities for purposes of these taxes.
Okay. So if you segment business activities sufficiently, you can tax the value of the transaction everywhere you find that segment.
I'm not sure that you could tax it everywhere, Your Honor. I think you could certainly, in your hypothetical, tax the two transactions of manufacturing and then sale or realization of gross receipts in another state. And I think that
the state of Michigan, if this were in the Ford case, could impose a tax, a manufacturing tax, on the same proceeds that the state of Delaware could impose for purposes of the wholesaler's tax.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the reason that doesn't impact the internal-external consistency analysis is because they're different activities.
Yes, Your Honor. External consistency asks again, does the division method reflect a reasonable sense of how the value or income is generated? And here, taxing gross receipts from sales of goods to Delaware retailers that are delivered in this state at the request of those retailers is a reasonable representative proxy for the economic activity in the state. Both Dial and Ford, and this is a fact that I believe the court below did not appreciate, control the delivery into this state. Dial enters into a contract with a requirements contract with trucking company, and it determines where Walmart or any other customer wants to have the goods delivered.
For purposes of our review, the critical facts as they pertain to Dial are that the Dial soap is manufactured and packaged outside of Delaware. It is then put on delivered to a common carrier, contracted for and controlled by Dial, and delivered into Delaware.
Yes, Your Honor.
In this case, to the Walmart Smyrna distribution center.
For most of the goods in issue.
Okay, and similarly, in the Ford case, the Ford vehicles are manufactured in Dearborn. They're dropped off and then put on a common carrier and similarly shipped to dealers in Delaware.
It's a somewhat more complicated chain of carriers, but yes, Your Honor, each of those carriers is under contract to Ford and not the dealers to whom delivery is being made.
Right, physical delivery.
Physical delivery, yes.
And if those same Ford vehicles were physically delivered to some Ford dealership or independent distributorship outside of Delaware before being shipped into Delaware, it would be a different case.
I believe, if I understand your question correctly, yes, the wholesaler's tax would not apply under your hypothetical to a delivery to a dealer outside of the state. If the dealer then were to redeliver.
What I'm saying is that functionally speaking, in both Dial and Ford, the manufactured goods could be treated as though they were delivered directly into Delaware by the manufacturer.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, then why does it matter where title changes hands?
Your Honor, I submit that it doesn't matter where title changes hands for purposes of this tax. We used to have a title passage test for this tax. The legislature changed that rule in 1984 to adopt the so-called destination test, that gross receipts from sales of tangible personal property physically delivered in this state to the buyer are taxable, rather than gross receipts from goods sold in Delaware.
And there's no legal authority that raises a question as to the appropriateness of a tax on something that has the title has passed outside of our jurisdiction?
There are a number of cases, I believe all but the Jefferson Lines case were decided prior to the decision in Complete Auto Transit, that looked to the locus of title passage, but that was in the context of sales taxes, not necessarily in the context of these gross receipts taxes, which the court in Jefferson Lines said were more closely related to income taxes. So, for example, the court in the Mormon manufacturing case, well, actually, the most closely on point case is the Tyler Pipe case, which concerned a gross receipts tax imposed by the state of Washington that was almost identical to ours, that also used a destination test. And in that case, the court, it was a short analysis, but it ultimately concluded that the tax was, quote, perfectly apportioned to the wholesaling activity in that state. I think if you look at the Mormon manufacturing case, there's some discussion, not of Tyler Pipe, which was later than Mormon, but of a Standard Press Steel, which was a case that preceded both Tyler Pipe and Mormon. And Mormon said that the Standard Press Steel Court had reached the conclusion that the tax in Washington was perfectly apportioned because it taxed only Washington sales, not sales of goods delivered into Washington, not all sales of goods. In other words, if there were delivery by the pipe manufacturer and Tyler Pipe to Idaho, the state of Washington wouldn't seek to tax that. It would tax only the deliveries into the state of Washington.
Let me go back to one question.
Certainly, Your Honor.
I understand that in both cases, external consistency is challenged. But
yes, Your
do
Honor.
I understand also that in one case, internal consistency, or I'm sorry, internal?
No, Your Honor.
Apportionment is
internal consistency was found by the court and wasn't really seriously challenged in either case.
So we're just talking
taxpayer.
About external.
Yes, the only bearing that the internal consistency test would have would be on Ford's claim that the tax discriminates against interstate commerce. In other words, that it taxes.
And your response is that whatever the tax, whatever the amount of the tax that was imposed in this case on Ford as an out-of-state manufacturer, the same tax would be imposed if Ford had actually built a plant in Delaware and sold those same automobiles to the dealers.
Or it had some distribution collection pool. If it had shipped these from one point in Delaware to another, it would have been the gross receipts result would have been the same. And as I was going a little bit into the Mormon manufacturing case, and I think that's a good case because it casts a side light on the court's analysis in Standard Press Steel and sort of it was cited by Tyler Pipe. In that case, was a formula apportionment case of a net income tax, but the formula used was Iowa destination sales over all sales, and that fraction was then multiplied against the net income of the corporation worldwide. And the state, there was a challenge in that case on the basis of fair apportionment, stating that other states, particularly Illinois, where the taxpayer had its manufacturing operations, used a three-factor apportionment formula, much like Delaware does for its corporation income tax, and that difference between the two approaches resulted in an overlap or multiple taxation. And the court in Mormon said, we're not going to get into the business of selecting what's the proper method of dividing the tax base. Also, after it had finished its reasoning almost as a backstop or check, it said that clearly the taxpayer would have had no complaint had the state of Iowa imposed a gross receipts tax like the tax in Washington that had been the subject of Standard Press Steel earlier, and in fact drew the analogy so closely, they said that the tax in Iowa, the net income tax, was roughly equivalent to a 1% gross receipts tax.
And that's precisely what happened in the Tyler Pipe case, correct?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. Tyler Pipe
and
was
in that
decided.
Case, at least as far as the wholesaler tax issue was concerned, the Supreme Court said that there was no external consistency problem.
It did not use the term external consistency, but it held the tax fairly apportioned, Your Honor.
Right, because the activity was wholesaling in only one state.
That's the way the court expressed it.
If there are two different activities, then the wholesaling can only take place in one state, I gather.
As to the sales that were subject, or as to the gross receipts subject to the tax, yes, clearly the Tyler Pipe Company was engaged in a multi-state business, as are Ford and Dial here. But the court did express it in terms of the wholesaling activity subject to the tax.
Is there any critical factual difference, that is from your side standpoint, between the tax scheme here and the tax scheme in the Tyler case?
No, Your Honor. Both were gross receipts taxes measured by sales, and the Washington tax has a number of different categories of activity, but they're measured by sales and as shown by the administrative regulations.
Are you saying, and I don't mean to characterize this unfairly, do we understand correctly that you're arguing that Tyler Pipe controls?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because the other side relies heavily on Tyler Pipe as well, which is a little puzzling.
The statute in Tyler Pipe defined sales as the passage of, I believe it was possession, title, or I can't remember the third leg. The administrative regulations under that statute that have been in effect since 1947 and which the state of Washington has used to enforce that statute has used a destination test. And that's attached to my reply brief in
the Dial
case.
You're saying to fully understand the factual the critical facts in Tyler Pipe, it's necessary to refer to that administrative.
It certainly casts a light on it. The Washington Supreme Court did not in any way discuss passage of title.
You're now into your rebuttal time. You're welcome to use it.
I'd like to save that for rebuttal, if I may, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm going to use Dial's 10 minutes to make one point. We think that the issue in this case is controlled by controlling authority from this court in the Franklin Fiber case. But before I discuss why that is, I want to give a little bit of background because at the beginning of the discussion, Justice Berger, you asked what the standard is and talked about the rational basis standard. And really, I got that from this court's recent decision in the Lehman Brothers case. The Lehman Brothers case, like this case, involves fair apportionment and involves external consistency. But Lehman Brothers involved an income tax. And the Supreme Court has said when you have a tax that you can't precisely identify a jurisdiction with, like an income tax or a value tax, it's okay to use a formula because it's impossible to precisely specify where an enterprise earns income. And when the state legislature uses a formula, it can use any formula that's reasonably related to the generation of income. However, the court has said in the Trinova case, if a taxable event can be precisely identify with a particular jurisdiction, it's not okay to use a formula. In this case, we have a tax, a gross receipts tax, call it a sales tax, but we have a tax that is triggered by a sale. If you don't make a sale, you don't pay the tax. The Supreme Court in Tyler Pipe, the Supreme Court has said that a wholesale sale is a wholly local event that only one state can tax. So the real question in front of this court is not whether a formula is rational or not, but where did the sale take place for tax purposes? And we think that this court has already decided that in the Franklin Fiber decision from 1986.
Well, aren't you overstating the matter a bit? That is, it isn't just a sale that triggers the wholesaler tax. If the sale is not accompanied by physical delivery of the goods into Delaware, there is no tax.
The tax is measured by the volume of the taxpayer's sales.
Yes, now, but the trigger is physical delivery. Isn't that correct?
That is true. And so if we could explore...
Not the sale. I mean, the sale may be a condition. It may be indispensable, but the statute focuses on physical delivery, unlike the statute that governed at the time the Franklin Fiber case was decided.
Fair enough. So let's explore that, because that was what Mr. McDaniel said was also the trigger in the Tyler Pipe case. This court had in front of it, the Superior Court had in front of it in 1986, the same tax. But at the time, that tax was imposed on the basis of sales that take place in Delaware. And the Superior Court held that a sale takes place in Delaware if title transfers in Delaware. Franklin Fiber said two things. One, the statute shouldn't read that way. But two, constitutionally, Delaware can't tax the sale because we ship it to our customers out of state. The Superior Court said, you're wrong, Franklin Fiber, on both points. First of all, you got the wrong read of the statute. The sale is imposed based on where title transfers. That's what we mean in our title transfer statute. But importantly for this case, the Superior Court also had a Commerce Clause decision, and it said only the state where title transfers may tax the sale. And the court repeated three times in the opinion, the destination state may not tax the sale under the Constitution, not under the statute. It had already ruled that the statute allowed it, but in reaction to Franklin Fiber's argument that the Constitution would allow only the destination states to tax it, the Superior Court said, au contraire, only the title transfer state may tax it. The destination states, it explicitly said, may not tax it.
This, but again, the scheme there was that the trigger for the tax was a sale, and sale is an indispensable requirement for a sale is the passage of title, and so the state where title passed is critical under that scheme. Correct.
That is right. But what Franklin Fiber did is it raised the specter of states with statutes like what Delaware has now. In other words, Franklin Fiber said, Your Honor, destination states
raising the specter of statutes of a statute that did not exist at the time and that wasn't before the court.
That's right. Franklin Fiber said to the court, Your Honor, you can't tax title transfer because destination states could impose a tax on the basis of being a destination state. And the Superior Court said, no, they can't. They are if they enacted a tax that did that, that tax would be unconstitutional.
Was that necessary to the decision in the case, or was that just dicta?
It was, because what the court was doing is relying on the notion that a wholesale sale, again, the Tyler Pipe says a wholesale sale is a wholly local activity that no other jurisdiction can tax. So we have to pick one or the other. Tyler Pipe doesn't say a wholesale sale is a wholly local activity that both the state where the sale takes place and the state of destination may tax. It says only one state may tax it. So when the court is deciding which state that is, it either has to pick the state where title transfers, or it has to pick the destination state. What we're saying is that this court has decided that that state is the state where title transfers. And Tyler Pipe does not say...
So you're saying Franklin Fiber is stare decisis on this point.
Precisely. So I think that the analysis then is, does Tyler Pipe or Jefferson Lines affect the stare decisis weight of Franklin Fiber. Franklin Fiber, incidentally, was...
Let me ask the question this way, Mr. Sully. If there had been no Franklin Fiber case, then under Tyler Pipe, basically the statute would not create any external consistency problem.
I think it would, and that's why I think let's walk through what happened. So Franklin Fiber was decided in 1986.
I'm saying forget Franklin Fiber. Assume it never was decided.
So in 1987.
So we're starting with a clean slate. We now have Tyler Pipe. Pipe says manufacturing and wholesaling are different. Wholesaling it can be taxed. The activity of wholesaling can be taxed. There's only one state that can do it, and that's the state where the wholesaling takes place. Doesn't that
it says
of
it
your
says precisely
case?
That, but it doesn't say destination. The statute that was in front of the Tyler Pipe Court.
No, it says wholesaling.
It says wholesaling, and wholesaling was defined by Washington statute as being the transfer of title or possession. The Supreme Court didn't address this rule that Mr. McDaniel has cited to the court. The court had in front of it a statute that was imposed on title transfer.
Well, the delivery would involve transfer of title or possession in Delaware too, correct?
Well, the under UCC law, possession transfers at the time on an FOB shipment contract, possession transfers to the buyer at the time that it is put on the carrier's conveyance. So possession transfers outside of Delaware.
Except
Delaware
that physical law. Delivery is the test, not possession.
Physical delivery is Delaware's statutory test.
Right.
But the Tyler Pipe rule is that the wholesale sale takes place where the sale takes place. And the Tyler Pipe statute was transfer of title or possession. Nothing about shipment to the ultimate customer. It simply doesn't say that. And then you've got Jefferson Lines.
But Tyler Pipe, the critical facts in Tyler Pipe are the same as the facts here, correct? That is, it's a state where physical delivery took place.
No, it was not a critical fact. There's nothing in the opinion in Tyler Pipe that says that title transfers outside of Washington.
The physical delivery of the goods was in Washington.
The physical delivery of the goods was in Washington.
For resale by the Washington retailer, is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. So in that sense, Tyler Pipe is on all fours.
In that sense, it's on all fours. There is ambiguity, though, about whether the sale is in the sale takes place where title transfers, the sale takes place where the product is shipped. That ambiguity was resolved by the Supreme Court in the Jefferson Lines case. And in that case, the court said a sale for tax purposes takes place where title transfers, and it's cited in the cloud. A gross receipts tax case for that premise. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the court. Thank you for allowing me to be here. May I please reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal? Your Honor, I'd like to follow up on the questions you asked and on the two presentations that we've had. And one of the first questions were, are there other issues? Well, we are heavy in the Commerce Clause, but we did raise the Due Process Clause before. And the McLeod case, counsel just referred to, is right on the money. It's a 1944 case, but it is the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a situation where someone like Ford was in doing things in Tennessee. Very little happened in Arkansas. Arkansas tried to tax it. The U.S. Supreme Court said no. The fair apportionment has these prongs. And the external consistency is about fairness. It's about overtaxation, which we believe we have massive overtaxation here. It's about multiple taxation, which we think we have here. There's no credit given us for what we paid, and the record shows stipulation, paragraph 31, that we paid gross receipts taxes to Missouri, we paid in other places. There's no credit. Now, Your Honor asked about, can you go over the line in Commerce Clause violations? The message of the container case which set up the difference between internal consistency and external consistency at the United States Supreme Court in 1983, was that there can be a net income tax formula apportionment with a 15% over the line, and it was okay because net income tax, you take the income everywhere, and then you have a formula to get a rough approximation. But where a tax is measured by gross receipts, as counsel said, we know where a gross receipt is. You don't need a formula apportionment. You know where it is, and you know if there's double taxation. Your Honor, you asked about the labels. I don't think they can just get away with it by labeling. I don't think one state can tax the same gross receipt by calling it a manufacturing tax, and another state by a wholesale tax, and another state by a delivery tax, and another state.
Well, you're putting the rabbit in the hat, aren't you? You're talking about the same activity.
Same receipt. The receipt.
The same. It may be the same receipt, but it's a receipt for a good that's been manufactured and then shipped into another state for a for purposes of a wholesale resale, correct?
No.
No?
We
Isn't
believe,
that what's
Your
going
Honor,
on here?
The heart of this is a gross receipt.
I'm sorry. You know, obviously the good that's being wholesaled has to be manufactured.
We manufacture it out
okay.
of state.
And the Supreme Court has said that is a separate activity from wholesaling, at least qualitatively.
Well, we don't think we even ship. The gate release in the automobile industry is a very significant event, and we did that out there.
Manufacturing and wholesaling are the same or different? Just tell me.
I think they're different, Your Honor, okay. But I think the same gross receipt cannot be taxed over and over and over.
Well, is anybody contending that?
Well, I think the U.S. Supreme Court in Trinova did say that you just can't call things different things, that a tax on sleeping, this is the court talking, measured by the number of pairs of shoes you have in your closet, is a tax on the shoes. And what we have here is a gross receipt, which is realized somewhere else. It's not for Ford. It's certainly not realized here.
Well, isn't it a calculation method for the value of the activity in the state? It may coincide with a calculation method for another activity somewhere else.
Our alternative position, Your Honor, is just that. That if we are a wholesaler, we're here, we know that. And they say, okay, we want to measure it by your gross receipts. But they shouldn't have 100% of the gross receipts where there's wholesaling activities spread across the country in many stages, very few of which are here, because Ford has nothing here. Ford has no plants here, no offices here, no employees based here. These dealers are independent. They're not our people. They're their own dealers. They buy this car. They take control. They take possession at the gate. They're not here. And they're involved in what happens at the plant. They make their request to have a certain color car there and a moon roof and things like that. So we think that if there is a tax and if the gross receipt is not totally excluded because it happened somewhere else, then the apportionment is good. But the way you apportion it, you take these gross receipts that they want, and we suggested three formulas.
Excuse me. Is there any other state that imposes a wholesaler tax on the proceeds that Ford receives from its Delaware dealers?
We are taxed
for the goods that are for the cars that are shipped into the state.
On the gross receipts, in Ohio, they have a tax called the CAT, the Capital Acquisition Tax. That's gross receipts tax. We're taxed in Virginia on a gross receipts tax. The record stipulation, paragraph 31, we're taxed in Missouri on these receipts. There's just multiple taxation without credit. Tyler Pipe rested heavily. My time up now?
Is that on the same vehicles?
Same vehicles. My rebuttal time is...
No, it'll turn yellow when it's your time.
Oh, rebuttal. Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Yes.
So are you making the same arguments in those states?
Well, I'm not there, Your Honor, so I'm not sure what they're doing, if anything. You know, I don't know. I just know that here... Almost.
I don't mean you personally. I mean your client.
I don't know. I can find out if you want, but I don't.
I'm a little confused. Is it your contention that Ford is paying for a gross receipts tax in another jurisdiction for cars that are coming to Delaware?
Yes. Yes, and I think stipulation paragraph 31 talks about the Missouri tax we pay, and there's no credit here. And Tyler Pipe rested on the fact there should be a credit when you have the same gross receipt that's taxed multiple times, because there's overtaxation, there's multiple taxation. So we have unapportioned tax on gross receipts that are not here.
Now, how is that done as a practical matter? Why wouldn't the credit go for what you pay in Delaware as opposed to what you pay in Missouri?
Delaware doesn't give us a credit.
I know, but assuming that it is structured, how would you structure it?
I think the department has formulas. I mean, I know where I live in New Jersey and I work in New York, and there is a credit system worked out, so there's no double taxation. But how they structure it, I think they just sort of compute what they think is due, and they see what you pay somewhere else, they deduct that, and then you pay the base, what's left. And I think, like in New York, the primary tax is, because I'm based in New York, well, the primary tax, I should think, would be in Missouri, where these cars are manufactured and they're sold at the gate.
Where is in the record is your, supporting evidence for the tax imposed by other states in the same?
Stipulation paragraph 31, Your Honor. I think that does it.
You want to reserve the remainder?
Please, can I, Your Honor?
I just have a few points, Your Honors. First, the McLeod case that was Mr. Solly and Mr. Frankel mentioned, the tax in that case was styled a gross receipts tax, but in the opinion, they treated it as a sales tax. And I think the Jefferson line case clearly stands for the point that on sales of goods, the analysis is slightly different. As far as the double taxation, stipulation paragraph 31 that Mr. Frankel, it appears that that is a manufacturing tax. I don't believe stipulation paragraph 31 addresses the Virginia tax, but that is the location of a manufacturing plant. So I think that what's being taxed in those locations is a different activity than what's being taxed.
Although it's based
here.
On gross receipts.
It's based on gross receipts because that's chosen as a measure of the manufacturing activity. I don't know that those statutes require a sale, for example. Maybe that simply if the goods are shipped elsewhere, the value of the goods becomes the base for the tax. But again, I have not read that statute, so I can't say that for sure. That in Delaware, there's clearly under our manufacturing tax the ability to impose the tax, notwithstanding the fact there's no sale. And if the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I didn't get to it before, but counsel referred to my Lehman case, our Lehman case. Well, they were headquartered here. There was a finding. And Ford, of course, is headquartered in Michigan, and all the plants are outside the state. Everything's outside the state, and the dealers are independent. They're not part of the Ford organization. There seemed to be a feeling below that there was this continual intertwining. There's no intertwining. The dealers are customers. They pick up the car. The title's theirs. The control's theirs, the possession is theirs, they can send their truck and pick it up, they can drive it away, they can do anything they want. It's up to them. The wholesaling is not local.
It's also fair to describe them as retailers, and you're the wholesaler.
They are the retailer. We do have salespeople who are not based here in this state who stop by about once a month to see how they're doing, and they give them an order, they send it to Michigan, it's accepted or not accepted in Michigan. There's minimal activity. There's massive overtaxation. You know, prong four.
Let me interrupt for a second. I probably ought to know the answer to this, but I don't. I assume that Ford's been doing business this way and has been taxed this way for many years. What happened?
Well, Your Honor, as you pointed out, the law changed, I guess, under the fibers, after the fiber case. And every now and then, the Tax Department of Corporate America hires somebody who looks deep into what's going on. And if they file something a certain way year in and year out, somebody says, well, maybe we should made a mistake. And that's why we have refund statutes. And they claimed a refund for making a mistake.
Thank you.
Mormon. The state relies heavily on Mormon. Mormon's a net income tax. So it does need one of these formulas to apportion the net income. And the issue there before the United States Supreme Court, should you have a single factor or should you have a three factor, it's not a gross receipts tax. This is a gross receipt tax, which is realized and recognized and booked and accounted for somewhere else. It's booked and accounted at that gate in Missouri or Ohio or Virginia, but not here.
And is it correct, as opposing counsel suggested, that at least in one of the other jurisdictions, the other tax is actually a manufacturing tax and not a gross receipts tax?
Your Honor, they have different labels. I agree with you on that. But it's the same gross receipt. And on closing, the Central Greyhound case. Can I finish? The Central Greyhound case. New York imposed a gross receipt tax on a bus line called Central Greyhound. And the bus line would go from New York City to Buffalo, New York. And the trip would take it through northern Jersey and Pennsylvania and then up to Buffalo. And we'll tax the whole receipt, said New York. No, you won't, said the U.S. Supreme Court, because part of it is realized and earned somewhere else. And that's
Thank
what
you.
We submit. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of the counsel, and we will take this matter under advisement. Thank you.